How will we power our future? Can we create a healthy and clean economy? Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is at the forefront of the global debate about energy, economy, and the environment. Bringing together the brightest and most provocative leaders of our time, Climate One is the place where big ideas get heard. With thoughtful and insightful discussions on policy, business, science, and culture, Climate One founder Greg Dalton gets to the heart of the matter. It's our future. It's time to come together.
On Earth Day in 2010, two historic events happened in the world of American energy. In the Gulf of Mexico, the blazing Deepwater Horizon oil rig fell into the Gulf, eventually spilling 170 million gallons of crude oil. At about the same time, on a military and Navy air base in Maryland, something else really important happened. The U.S. Navy tested an F/A-18 Super Hornet, a fighter jet that was powered by blend of petroleum and biofuels. If the BP oil disaster was a wake-up call about the costs and dangers of extracting fossil fuels, the U.S. Navy heard it loud and clear. Navy Secretary Ray Mabus set an ambitious goal of providing half of the power that the Navy uses on shore and afloat from renewable non-fossil fuels by 2020. I should say non-fossil fuels because it includes nuclear energy. Can that goal be met? How? What will the impact will the Navy have on other branches of the armed services and commercial markets for technology such as biofuels and solar power? That will be our topic of our conversation for the next hour with our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and two experts. We're delighted to have with us the Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Energy and Installations, Jackie Fanensteel, and Jeremy Carl, who's a research fellow at the Hoover Institute at Stanford University. Please welcome them to Climate One. So, Assistant Secretary Fanensteel, let's begin with you. What is the strategic and national security aspect of moving away from fossil fuels for the U.S. Navy? Why is it doing?
We're doing it to make better warfighters. We see energy as a vulnerability, both in the short term, tactically. The largest import to Afghanistan, to the actual theater going on, oil and water. For every 50 fuel convoys in Afghanistan, we have a casualty, an American who's killed or wounded. So there's an enormous tactical vulnerability.
We've all seen those photos of the fuel convoys aflame.
Correct. But there's also a strategic imperative here where we're buying our oil from parts of the world that are unstable sometimes, from countries that are not always our friends. And that vulnerability, that strategic vulnerability, is something that we absolutely have to wean ourselves off of.
Okay. Jeremy Carl, do you agree that there's a strategic imperative or strategic aspect to moving away from fossil fuels?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And I think that ultimately the things that will be most successful, particularly within the military context, are those things that really focus on that strategic imperative and improving warfighting capability in particular. Things that are green, just in and of themselves, are nice, but I think are ultimately at risk, particularly in a tight budgetary environment, if they don't actually contribute to the kind of core military mission. But I do think that we do have these strategic vulnerabilities that can be genuinely addressed by some of the things that the military is right now doing with renewables, and the Navy is really the leader in that.
So it's not as though the Navy's suddenly become tree huggers. They're doing this for strategic reasons. Jeremy, you also believe that there's been some hype and overpromise around alternative fuels in the past. Is this time different?
I do have some concerns. I think that, I mean, if you go back again, even to solar and wind, going back to the 70s when these things first showed up, there's been a lot of promises about what they can do that have sometimes been a little more than what they can deliver. On the same token, you've had a 60% drop in solar panel prices since 2009. Some of that is structural, some of that is China, but I mean, a lot of that is real gains. You have First Solar, actually, a U.S. company, is now the low-cost producer. A lot of people talk about China, but they don't realize that. They're based in Tempe, I believe. So I do think these things have been oversold at times, but I do think that they could potentially be different. The Navy has set itself a very aggressive goal with biofuels to be sort of 50%. I'm sure Secretary Fanensteel can speak a little more to that. I think that it's very ambitious. I do have some concerns, and I think those are echoed by Senator Warner and some others about you know, the longer term of whether we'll really be able to get the cost differential down to that being achievable. But certainly the dollars of private capital that are flowing in to make this happen now are at a much greater scale than they were before.
And if I might, I think that that is the fundamental question. Is this time different? Those of us who've been in the energy field for a long time have seen ebbs and flows of American interest, American investment, new technologies that look like they will be the breakthrough technologies that, that could have been and then prove not to be. We have heard not long ago former EPA Administrator
Bill Riley yeah.
saying, you know, if it's all based on the price of oil, that's probably not going to work because oil prices go up, oil prices go down, and you see the interest in technology investment going up and going down. And there's a seem to be a growing consensus that there needs to be some public policy, some public effort, really long-term, a commitment at this time. And I agree totally. If we are just following oil prices, it's not going to be really much different this time than any other time. There's more fossil fuels coming out of the ground than we thought there would be. But there are several things that are very different this time. One is technology improvements. The solar costs are coming down, and that's making an enormous difference. The technology of automobiles, both hybrids, which is a well-known, well-developed technology, and now I think a greater increase in electric-only automobiles. So those things, the technologies are improving. But I would advocate, would argue that the interest of the military at this point in promoting alternative fuels, alternative technologies, is an enormous difference. The military has led in the U.S. in several technologies that have now become standard. They've led in some of the computer technologies and GPS, many others that we can name. And this time, the Navy has said, we will get 50% of our energy from non-fossil fuels within the decade. And so we're investing, we're purchasing, we're exploring, we're researching in those areas.
So what caused that leadership change? Because a lot of these fundamental arguments about the vulnerability of supply lines, that's not new. I hear the point that there's alternatives. Now the monopoly that oil has had, finally there's another... some competition in the marketplace. But what I'm very curious about, what caused that mind shift in the leadership? Was it the change of administration?
I do think it is leadership. I think that it is fundamentally leadership. President Obama has made it clear that this is the path that he wants to go down in terms of alternative energy. Secretary Mabus has been out there in front. Secretary Mabus was an ambassador to Saudi Arabia. He understands up close and personal what the oil, the international oil situation is. He understands the vulnerabilities. So he came in as Secretary of the Navy recognizing that we needed to wean ourselves off of that vulnerability and has provided the leadership to do so. Within this past year, I think April or February of this year, of 2011, President Obama directed the Department of the Navy with the Department of Energy and the Department of Agriculture to work towards developing a viable biofuels industry in the United States. He said, you three agencies, do what you need to do, but let's get that industry out there, not just for nuclear, not just for military uses, but for commercial uses as well. So we're in that path.
Jeremy Carl, do you think the Navy's out front on this, and it's because of the leadership of the Secretary?
Yeah, I do. And Assistant Secretary Fantasio was modest in not mentioning her own contribution here, but she's been a leader. I think Admiral Cullum also, who's been heading up things from the flag officer level for the Navy, has really been very strong leader here. We've had a lot of interactions with him, and so I do think that leadership has been absolutely critical, and it certainly explains some of. I was just down last week at the Naval Energy Forum in Washington D.C., and one of the things I really took away was it was surprising senior officers throughout the Navy, not just folks with direct line responsibility for energy, were there giving talks, and I think really showing some knowledge, and I think that shows a priority. To that, I would add, again, I think the real development of technology Again, for solar, for example, the whole development of thin film solar printing and the vastly better module efficiencies that we're getting than just a few years ago allows you to have the sort of juice to supply and the sort of industrial strength manufacturing to make them ruggedized so that you can have something like India 3-5 company for the Marines, where you have these expeditionary forces that have been able to go out in Afghanistan and shed 700 pounds of batteries. That's a real operational gain. And then when you get to those sorts of real operational gains versus what you were doing before, well, if it costs 2 or 3X in the context of the operation, that's not as important as it is for, say, a utility. Okay, so I think it's a combination of leadership and technology.
And it's one thing to put out goals. It's another thing to actually meet them. So how far is the Navy along toward meeting these goals of half fuels by renewable fuels by 2020?
Secretary Mabus set out those goals a year or so ago, and then, you know, he brought me in.
He told you to make it happen.
Make it happen. You know, let's make this work. And people ask me frequently, are these just aspirational goals? Are these just to get our thinking in that direction? And my answer is always no, they're real. We're going to do them. And so let's look at what they are. What are these goals that we're trying to accomplish? The first, as you have said, that half of our energy use will be non-fossil, non-traditional fuels by 2020, within the decade.
Including nuclear.
Including nuclear. That half of our bases, and that's Marine Corps and Navy bases, or about 100 of them around the world, that half of those will be zero net energy by 2020. In other words, they'll produce as much as they use. That half of our non-tactical fleet are trucks and buses and cars that we use on bases, for example, will be alternative fuels by 2015. That we will sail a great green fleet, in other words, a carrier strike group with the planes and ships that go with that, will sail it by 2016 and we'll have it ready to go we'll sail it by 2012, next year, and we'll have it ready to go outside of local operations by 2016. And the last is a very important goal, because it's longer term, is that we'll consider energy in our new platforms, in our new systems that we develop, that will make energy one of the deciding factors as we go ahead and invest in new technologies. So your question was, how are we doing? We're making amazing progress. And I'll mention two specific areas that make the big difference. On the bases, half of the bases being zero net energy, that's an enormous hill to climb. Some of the bases are in places where renewable energy makes a lot of sense. They're in places that have a lot of sun, where they have high energy prices that they'd be paying, so these things pencil out more easily. Renewable power makes a lot more sense. We have some that don't. The bases are very focused on doing this, and doing this, by the way, within a financially constrained budget. Nobody has unlimited money to put into this. And so every base that I have visited has an enormous program of energy efficiency that penciled out. They're replacing their lights, they're replacing their HVAC systems, they're remodeling their buildings to be more efficient. They're very much focused on how to do that. And we're doing some smart grid work. We're going to try to tie in some groups of bases on a smart grid so that they can share their renewable power. So on the base side of it, they're developing the technologies. They're developing the culture to develop the technologies besides. Very important. On the 50% overall, one thing that's important to recognize is that about 75% of the energy that the Navy uses is for operations, not on the bases. So we have about 75% that ships planes and tactical vehicles. That is primarily about liquid fuels, mm-hmm. because we need a drop-in fuel. We need a fuel that will work with the existing platforms, the existing engines. So we're working very hard with the biofuel industry. We're making enormous strides in working with them. Will they be ready in the time frame we have? We believe that they will. We are both working with them as a potential customer, and having a customer with the kind of demand we have gives them enormous credibility in their marketplace. But we also are using some existing authorities that we have to do some investments. We're working with the Department of Energy, Department of Agriculture, to be able to do some seed investment in the biofuels industry.
Well, what percentage of the fuel the Navy uses today is renewable?
It's a very small percentage right now. I would say it's, well, depending on how you consider geothermal, but it's about 10-11%.
Oh, even that high? I didn't realize it was that high. Okay. So you got 40% to go in 9 years, something like
and
that.
And 11%, 17%, I believe, is nuclear.
Uh-huh.
So, but,
okay.
You know.
Okay, so you're a third of, well, you got 30-some,
yeah,
20-something.
And the 10-11%, again, it's sort of a, if you take some of the, if you take geothermal, which is we have an enormous geothermal facility that's on our base but is feeding into the grid.
So that's heat coming out of the earth that generates electricity.
Exactly, and that's sometimes considered as ours and sometimes it's considered not as ours. And if you take those megawatts out, then we're down in a couple percentage. So it's a small percentage now, I think, in terms of where we need to go.
And it seems that, if I heard you correctly, the big goal is liquid transportation fuels, and that's where second generation or cellulosic biofuels
yes.
come in. And these don't compete with food stocks.
Right.
And how far away are you? You've done some testing, mm-hmm. blending this with jet fuel. How far are you away from really having that deployed in standard use, some biofuels and petroleum?
We think that we're fairly close. We have very strict criteria for the biofuels that we're going to use. Have to be domestically produced, have to not compete with food stock, have to be at a price point that makes sense, have to be useful in existing platforms.
Makes sense? That means cheaper than regular
yes.
gasoline?
Oh, at parity with regular
JP8, the fuel.
And again, because one doesn't know what the price of oil is going to be, so you don't know what the price of JP5 is going to be at any time. But it has to be in parity. We cannot buy quantities of fuel with a subsidy. So for long periods of time, we can. Right now, we're buying small amounts to test. But, you know, when we get to quantity, and the last criterion I'd mention is they need to be scalable. They need to be able to be up to where we need them. And some studies have said that without intervention, public intervention, it's probably going to be a decade or so before you have these biofuels at scale. But with some kind of intervention, and I think we have two possibilities. One is as a customer, and the other is perhaps as a small investor in the industry. You can get them moving much faster. You can avoid this valley of death that many new technologies go into because you'll help them bridge both with some investment and with a contract out there. So we are looking to sail the Great Green Fleet by 2012 and then have it beyond just local operations for 2016. That's a lot of biofuels. And yes, it will be mixed with conventional fuels, but it's still a lot of biofuels.
Jackie Fannin-Steel is an Assistant Secretary of the Navy. Our other guest at Climate One today is Jeremy Carl from the Hoover Institution. Jeremy, is this a good thing, the Navy creating a market for biofuels?
I think, you know, I'll give that at least a qualified yes. Again, I probably have greater concern. It's great that Secretary Fannin-Steel, I think, totally operationally needs to have that optimism about their ability to scale and get those costs down. I have a greater concern, particularly on the cost side. I think on the scale side, we're seeing some pretty aggressive things. And we actually hosted Secretary Mabus not so long ago, and he sort of casually dropped into conversation a very large order that the Navy's put in for biofuels that is currently, you know, in process of being met, sort of at a much greater scale than anything that's been done commercially. So I think that there are genuine security reasons at a reasonable budget, and one can vary on what might be reasonable to sort of at least test these concepts. Cellulosic alternative biofuels have been 10 years away for a long time, and I don't mean to use that to dismiss things because I do think that just the level of seriousness and scale is much different now. But I wouldn't want to undersell that challenge either. I think there's no certainty that we will get to the place we need to be, at least with that respect to that. Some of the other expeditionary things I'm a great deal more optimistic about.
Well, let's talk about that cost issue, because we've had CEOs of drop-in fuel companies. These are companies that make fuels that can go in existing vehicles, go in existing pumps, go in existing fineries. No one needs to change any of their infrastructure. And they make these pronouncements, we're going to be making this much by this date, and they fall back because it's hard to do this stuff at scale. And are they coming in where you want them to and at a price that is competitive yet? Or is it something that, well, we promise if this chart continues to go like that, are they based on extrapolation or actuality?
We've all seen those promises in the past, haven't we? We're working with them, and we do see that they have the potential to get there at the level, the amount we need, at the price we're willing to pay in the time frame. So all of those things, there is nothing that is a deal killer at this point. I've been in the energy field long enough to know that there are a lot of heartbreaks. Yeah. There are a lot of things that are supposed to be there that aren't.
Or a deal killer you don't see yet. Right?
And there are a lot of surprises. I mean, who projected the Prius? Who really thought that Americans would take on that kind of hybrid technology and not just be willing to do it, but really make it work? So I'm not counting on those surprises. I mean, we're working very hard to make that happen. And we're working with the industry, we're working with the venture capital community, we're working with the academic community. So we're not sitting back and assuming it's going to happen. We are with that industry every day. And so do we think that we're going to get the quantities we need in the time we need them? Yes, we do.
One of the obstacles is financing and capital costs. It can cost $1 billion to build a big biofuel facility, whatever the input is, whether it's corn or sugar, et cetera. Is the Navy going to pay for that? Some of the companies say, hey, that's a big capital cost in this tight economy. Where are they going to come up with $1 billion for something that is still cutting edge?
If I could actually jump in on that for a second, I think one of the really interesting things, and particularly the Valley has slowly learned this after losing a fair bit of money on some ventures, is that this is not like the tech industry, right?
This is not two kids coding in their
exactly.
dorm room.
Exactly, yeah. And it just, you can't stress that enough. This is not a brilliant, unique insight that I'm making here, but it can't be stressed enough because I think lay people don't necessarily understand that. You have these huge capital costs. The bets are so large. The sorts of the ways that we're used to funding innovative companies at small scale in this country don't immediately translate. And the funders, so there's a whole cultural shift that is going to need to happen, and new forms of financing are going to have to come up. And there may be a role for the government in certain amounts of this. I'm not wild about loan guarantees. That was true even before Solyndra. I'm now even less wild about them. But I do think that there are scaling demonstration plants, sustained basic support for R&D, and these sorts of things are very important roles for the government to be playing.
Well, may I, one way that we're actually putting some money into this, mm-hmm. besides our role as a consumer, we have existing legislative authority to support through an investment, the Department of Defense does, support through investment industries that we consider to be or that Congress has considered to be crucial to defense. Energy is one such industry. And so the Department of the Navy, Department of Defense, I think, is actually going to put some money, about $170 million, into a fund that will be met by the Department of Energy, Department of Agriculture, each putting in the $170 million. You'll have a fund of about $500 million, which then will be matched at least in kind, mm-hmm. at least one-to-one, by private investors. So you'll have then a pot of $1 billion, and that will be used for new refineries, to redo refineries, to help with that initial capital cost. That's a project that's underway as we speak, where we won't be picking the winners. We won't be picking a specific technology, but there will be some funds available, which will be equity funds, into some 4 or 5 or 3, however many we can do, refineries for exactly this point. And then we'll be a customer. And so we'll be able to take some some of the product out to meet our needs.
And where are the big oil companies in this? Are they sitting on the sidelines? Are they trying to slow things down, throw gum in the wheels?
They're players. I mean, I think every major oil company has some investment in biofuels.
Yeah, I mean, I could just add to that. I mean, yesterday, literally, I met with a few other people, and Chris Somerville, who heads a $500 million effort over here in Berkeley, totally dedicated to advanced biofuel research that's being funded by BP, basically in its entirety. I think maybe there's some matching funds from elsewhere, but that's just part of $3 billion, I think, that BP has put into biofuels generally in the last few years. So, I mean, yes, oil companies are going to look after their bottom line, and there may be strategic considerations and competition, but I think they definitely see broadly that this is an area that at least could be very meaningful, and they're investing in it, and not just a kind of some of the annoying ways that you'll see them advertising, kind of a very marginal investment, but making it act like it's a big part of their portfolio. I mean, these are actually very serious bets that the billions of dollars are money, really, even to oil companies. So.
And it's not just the military that's interested in this. We are out there right now, but commercial aviation is enormously interested in biofuels.
And there's some real policy drivers for why that's happening, right?
That's right. Europe is putting some carbon fees on landing fees in the EU. And so commercial aviation.
So European vacations are about going to get more expensive for everybody, right?
And if you can really decouple the biofuel cost from oil cost, which we certainly don't do with ethanol, where you have basically 54% of that coming out of the oil market. So, I mean, that's why those two markets never really decouple. If you can really do it, that serves for commercial aviation even some strategic goals because they get killed. When
oil prices spike.
Right. Saw that American Airlines released its results yesterday. So, again, and I don't think they, just like the Navy, I don't think they want to put all of their bets just on this one thing. But to the extent that they've got choices and they can arbitrage in a meaningful way, even maybe if it's a slight premium to the oil market in most cases, I think they'd love to have that option value there.
Jeremy Carl is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Our other guest today at Climate One of the Commonwealth Club is Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Jackie Pfanstiel. I'm Greg Dalton. Let's talk about the appropriate role of government here. Some people would say we're venturing into industrial policy here. Jeremy, you're from a free market organization. Is government playing the appropriate role here?
Well, this is a subject of lively debate internally, and I should say there's certainly no official Hoover position. My own view, again, is I am not a fan, personally, of sorts of programs where at a very large scale, Tesla being another example, where we're kind of making bets on individual private companies and investors. I don't think that's the best role. And even as Larry Summers said, it was slightly unprintable, but he said in an internal White House email that the government is not a particularly good venture capitalist. And I subscribe to that. Where, again, I think the appropriate role is basic R&D funding, where it's critical. I think bridge funding and even building at a very large cost. If Solyndra had been a demonstration plant and just been run by Solyndra, but we weren't actually kind of giving ownership of that private capital to somebody else, I think that sort of thing, if you really think that from a technology perspective that's an interesting bet to make, that's a slightly different question. I think the problem gets in where you get into these sorts of cozy relationships that I think we've seen, again, in Solyndra, even if there was no actual intent to defraud, but it just people's judgment can get kind of swayed.
Well, on Solyndra, I was told by a reporter that the Bush administration thought when it left that Solyndra was likely to be among the first to receive some funds. So that was already pretty far down the pipeline before some of this coziness came along.
Yeah, well, I mean, we could go back and forth. I mean, actually, I think I truly don't think this is necessarily a plus or minus, but I think there's actually pretty good evidence that the Bush administration was going to let that funding go. There was a very large push at the end of the Bush administration to get that funded by folks close to Solyndra, and they sort of passed. But I think even placing the blame on one administration, I'd rather kind of stay away from that, at least for the purposes of this. I think it's whether it's the Bush administration or the Obama administration or any future administration, I don't personally like to see that type of bet being made by the government. I just don't think it's the thing we do best.
But can the government and taxpayers accept failures? I mean, because private funding, you put 50 chips down, a lot of them are going to fail, some are going to hit big, but taxpayers and voters seem to be very risk-averse to any kind of failure, even though in the grand scheme of things, there might be more winners than
losers. But I think when you have a demonstration plant, you kind of take that off the table, and that's why I mentioned it. And that could be at a very large scale, but it just then you don't get into the question of, oh, well, this private investor may have or may not have a cozy relationship. I mean, you kind of do things at the same scale, and maybe at some point even you sell it to the person who's been operating it at some kind of very transparent way, but you kind of avoid some of these conflicts of interest that I think both politically and substantively are going to really plague some of these programs going forward post-Solyndra.
Jackie Fanisteel, how's the Navy set up to handle failures? Some of these bets just go south. Are you ready for that? What's going to be the consequences? Is that going to be acceptable? Because it certainly is in the investor community, right? Failure is a badge of honor and courage in Silicon Valley, but not necessarily in government.
Not so much in government. We're out there as customer, fundamentally, primarily. We know what we want to buy in the way of biofuels. We know what price, we know what scale, we know what qualities they have to bring to us. That's our fundamental role. We're not attempting, we don't intend to pick a technology. We don't know whether it's going to be, whether it's a feedstock, whether it is camelina, which is what we used.
It's a mustard.
It's a weed. It's a mustard weed. It's used as a rotational crop sometimes. It grows about anywhere. Has some great possibilities. Is it going to be some other crop? There are a lot of different technologies. We do think that we can do R&D, and we are doing R&D. We're working with Department of Energy on R&D. So that's all fine. But ultimately, where we are in the entire story is we want to fuel our ships and our planes with some non-fossil fuel product. And we need to be there in the marketplace to make sure that that's going to happen.
And you can make some companies more viable, get them funding, et cetera, by being that customer and creating that kind of demand pull that consumers may not be quite ready yet to do some of the things on the scale that you're willing to do.
That's exactly right. And it's true in biofuels. It's true in renewable energy on bases. We're doing excellent stuff with solar on bases. We're looking for many opportunities to be cost-effective users of solar, whether it's rooftop solar or parking lot solar or... In some cases, we may have the opportunity to do some small utility scale. We've got about 100 megawatts of solar kind of on the drawing boards now, projects that we're thinking about. So that's another area where we're a consumer, where we need certain product at a certain price.
And China, as we all know, has driven down the cost of photovoltaic solar recently. Are you finding that solar is price competitive with traditional electricity on these bases, or what's the cost differential you're looking at? Because you could get good prices because you got scale.
Not yet. The solar generally is not yet cost competitive. There are specific attributes where it is.
Is it 5% more expensive, 50% more expensive?
That varies so much because it depends on where it is and where you bought it from. But we are... we're looking at all different applications. In some cases, down in San Diego where you can do some rooftop, we're looking at China Lake Naval Weapons Station, we're looking at 29 Palms, a Marine Corps base. A lot of very, very promising places for those kinds of technologies. Wind is a cheaper technology, but has some operational constraints around military bases, so harder to find the right place for wind turbines. We have geothermal plant, as I mentioned, at China Lake. We're looking at other opportunities for that. So a lot of the alternative technologies that are land-based, based on our different installations around the world, making an enormous investment in them.
But you're willing to pay a little more. Jeremy Carl, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I agree with everything Secretary Fanisteel just said there. I wanted to just kind of add partly a shameless plug and partly as a kind of adding some information. So we have a report that we're releasing with the Brookings Institution in a couple weeks that looks at distributed power broadly, including its security elements. One of the things we did, we worked with E3, which is going to be well known to folks here in the energy community, really a top-tier energy consulting group and kind of modeled, you know, the latest, you know, down to like 2 months ago costs for some of these distributed technologies like solar and wind.
Distributed, we should explain, is sort of small things, not a big industrial power plant.
But sure, or at least close to the load. Sometimes distributed can actually be quite large, things close to the load, so sort of things like on bases. And what you find is there's still a pretty large cost increment in most cases. You'll find certain things like wind, small wind, can be competitive, although it has operational problems for the Navy that Secretary Van Steele alluded to. Some types of solar, so some niche applications, but even with carbon prices, we're still not there if economics is the only criterion, or even if economics in a reasonable climate thing is the only criterion. Is if you expand the field a little bit, there's some non-quantifiable values that are there that I think, you know, can justify some. But again, this is when you made the earlier reference to things being oversold, that's the sort of thing I'm talking about. You see a lot of very bad information. Stuff we have in this report is the best, most current information. It's not politically slanted at all. It's straight down the middle, and we've still got a ways to go.
And that's from Hoover and the Brookings Institution. What's the ways to go? What's the direction of the prices? I mean, if you looked at a year ago, and solar's gone down, what, 30%?
It's great. It's great. I mean, and that's we have a snapshot in time, and we say that absolutely in the report. And again, we've seen tremendous improvements, fuel cells, solar, wind, the whole bit. We are getting better. These are no longer science fair projects. They're things that real capital is being deployed against. And I'm very optimistic over the longer term, but I think one of the things that sets you up for failure is when you get these overpromising, and then Secretary Van Steele used to work at PG&E and then at the California Energy Commission at the very, very senior levels. And she sees these sorts of promises come in, and then when they're not delivered on, it creates more problems than if they just hadn't been made at all.
So. And I do think that what we are seeing on the technology front is everybody has been looking, in the time I've been in this field, looking for the silver bullet, the technological breakthrough. Aha, this will happen, and we won't have to worry about any of the rest of it. We've not seen that. I, for one, have stopped looking for the silver bullet. But what I am finding is some of the unsexiest things, some of the energy efficiency, the lighting, the building envelope, the insulation has made enormous improvements. Refrigerators are just an entirely different technology than they were a couple decades ago. Those kinds of changes, if you really focus them on them, we see it's made all the difference. And so when we look at solar panels and the 30% reduction in cost of solar panels, again, that's not a specific breakthrough. That's not somebody working in their garage and say, aha, I found the answer. It's this constant American way of improving the technology. A lot of the solar panel, I was just reading an article the other day, a large part of that reduction cost of solar panels is silicon. A couple years ago, 3 or 4 years ago.
Which is basically made from sand.
Sure.
Yeah, solar panels, which depend on silicon, were getting quite expensive because there was a shortage of silicon. Now, silicon comes from sand, so it's a product that's or a material that's available, but it has to be refined or whatever you call it into silicon. Well, supply and demand. There was a demand for it, and now the supply has caught up. Since that supply has caught up, the price of silicon has gone down, the price of panels has gone down. All of those things are happening, and they're happening as we speak. How quickly, what do you want to bet in terms of the timing is, I think, really the big question that we're talking about.
And there's also the information management aspect. Secretary Mabus of the Navy, Secretary Mabus was here and said, we don't know where a lot of the energy goes once it's at the base, like a lot of homes or a lot of corporate campuses. So you're doing smart meters. Is that going to have an impact on the management of information so all the guys who are running those refrigerators keeping the beer cold, that they know how much that's cost?
Is that what we're doing in the business? enormous difference. We, within the next couple years, we're going to have about 98% of all of our electricity on smart meters throughout our bases. And so we are going to know where that's coming from, where the energy is being used, how it's being used. We're going to be able to do things like compare one barracks to another. We're going to be able to look at the ship, when the ships come in and plug in, how one ship compares to the other. hangars, all of that stuff, which we don't have now. But we want to do more than monitor. We want to be able to use that as a basis to be able to, you know, shut down one part of the base if we don't need it and still protect our mission critical loads somewhere else. We want to use that as a basis for doing some control on our base. Because the other thing that we want to use these smart meters for is cultural change. Okay. We want to get that information to people who are actually flipping the light switch or changing the air conditioning in their barracks room. We want people to understand in a way that I think they haven't, frankly, most Americans don't think about the energy they use. This is a really good opportunity. So that change to the smart meters, I think it's going to make an enormous difference on our bases.
It's one thing to give information. It's another to put it in sort of budgets and operational responsibilities. We had the chief sustainability person here from Microsoft recently who said, for the first time, Microsoft is putting the budget for the data center, the energy for the data centers, mm-hmm. in the data center budget. And it's like before, it's just like facilities pays the budget. I want big servers. I want them fast. I don't care how much electricity they use. Now they got to pay mm-hmm. the electricity charge, and things start mm-hmm. to change. So are you going to put the budgetary responsibility in the operational chain of command for energy?
That's an excellent comparison with you know what Microsoft is doing there, because we are thinking that way. And right now the base pays the energy budget, the electricity bill for the base, even though they have tenants on the base. They have people who are using the hangars and people who are using the industrial facilities and all of that. So yes, we need to start thinking about letting them know and then perhaps migrating that big change. It would be
a big
administrative change as well as a big cultural change. But ultimately, the culture needs to understand that and allow you to get there.
And how do you change culture in something as big as the U.S. Navy? And
this has been a big thing, something that actually I think we're going to be working with along with MIT and the Navy to sort of identify I hope I'm not pre-announcing anything too much, but identify different ways that you can change that culture, in all different respects, and it's a challenge. I mean, even just incentives. I know one thing I believe that's being done in the Navy right now is just, as opposed to this energy always being free for individual soldiers or sailors, kind of a fee-based type system, right. And rewards. There are pockets of resistance, I think, as one might say, to that. But on the other hand, I think. Once people get that in their mind, what has been seen, at least I believe in the initial experimental runs, has been a 10% reduction
right.
in electricity use by sailors, just because people are suddenly, they're now, the folks in the Navy are aware of what they're
right.
doing. And George Shultz is very fond of saying that it's amazing what you can accomplish once you actually just start paying attention to the thing. And I think the military is now really paying attention to what's going on.
That's fine. I absolutely agree. We are doing some pilots in terms of giving people exactly that information and doing some shadow billing on that. So that's going to make a difference. We're doing more in the way of rewards and recognition, just kind of letting people see who's making the biggest changes in their energy use and making a big deal about that. We have very, very, I think, effective programs there. We've actually started a master's program at the Naval Postgraduate School in energy.
Mm.
First year, it was two tracks, one in policy, one in operational. So, again, we're trying all ways we can think of to get the word out there.
Because when you said earlier that the Navy is going to consider energy in weapon designs, I thought, you mean that wasn't considered before? I guess cheap oil was just, or was not sort of, wasn't.
Well, and some of these new weapons are incredibly energy intensive. I mean, you're going to lose, you really need that because you're going to lose a lot of that gain through some of these more advanced guns that are being deployed.
But if I heard you correctly, energy wasn't a big deal before. Well, it uses what it uses. Performance is what matters.
Performance is what matters, and it's probably not unlike American level of their cars for all
right,
those
performing.
Years. You know, it's there. It's something you knew, you thought about, but it probably wasn't a decision factor.
Jackie Fansteel is Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And our other guest today at Climate One is Jeremy Carl from the Hoover Institution. I'm Greg Dalton. Let's talk about the political context in which this is happening. Budgets, et cetera. There's potential budget cuts for the Pentagon. Are some of these programs going to get whacked?
we look at these programs as, in fact, being part of how we're going to meet the constrained budgets. We look at these programs as helping us be more effective with what we have.
Save money over time.
Save money over time, and in some cases, save money in the short term. We have some energy efficiency programs that have good paybacks, very effective paybacks. So we may be focusing more on the short payback programs, but no, we're not putting our energy programs on the front of what might be cut. We clearly, it's a time within the Pentagon where everything has to be looked at, has to be scrutinized in a way that we probably haven't had to do for a while. And, you know, energy is something that not everybody understands the same way we do. But so we need to be able to make the case that energy is, in fact, part of our solution.
But we have a Congress that recently tried to go backwards on some mandated light bulb efficiencies. So energy,
well, this
Jeremy
is
Carl?
Mission. And when I talk to people in all different branches of service, and we're not just talking to the Navy, I mean, that is the really key component. Is anything that you have that really saves energy but does so in a way that enhances the core mission, keeps a ship sitting there from sitting there and refueling, interesting things the Navy's doing there too, allows patrols to go out further because they're not as dependent on an energy supply line, or they don't have to carry as many heavy batteries. That sort of stuff is going to be safe in any budgetary environment. Even, frankly, if it's at a little bit of a cost increment, I think it'll be safe because that is, again, just the centrality of the mission. I think there are some other things that will be more at risk because they're sort of things that may have paybacks over time, or they may be interesting and experimental and push the envelope, but...
Are biofuels in there? Are biofuels
at risk? That is my concern for some of it. I don't mean to just say that blanket because it's a very large initiative, but I think when you talk about it, at least at the top end of those goals, and that's a concern shared by folks like former Senator Warner, who you know, is the former chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee and certainly in a better place to really understand how those budget appropriations processes
work. And a former Secretary of the Navy.
And a former Secretary of the Navy, thank you. So, and you know, he's concerned, as I am, in a friendly way. I mean, we'd like to see these things go forward, and there's a concern that, you know, if that cost increment is not able to get shaved down, that boy, it's going to look like a tempting area to cut, especially because leadership is obviously not permanent, and political environments and dynamics change, and what you want to do is something that really is permanent and predictable.
Well, let's address that. Next year there's an election. There may be a change of administration, maybe not. I mean, how much of this could be undone, or how much of this will be sort of set rolling that'll be some continuity across administration change when there is one?
It's very important for us to institutionalize this transformation, and we do see it as a transformation of how we work with energy. And we're institutionalizing it through really many of our programs, what we're doing. Biofuels, I think it's an excellent example, because we want to be able to purchase biofuels at the quantities we need, at the price we need, that meet the criteria that we've laid out. And that's gonna happen. We're in the process of making that happen. Once those biofuels are available to us, that then is what we will be using for our Great Green Fleet. We've set in place both on the bases and operationally products and practices that we're not going to go back on. The Marines who are using these new technologies in Afghanistan like the new technologies. They free them from the battery requirements.
They have to carry around less weight, right?
They have to carry less weight. They have these their tents are cooler. They don't need the kind of diesel for air conditioning. They've found ways to adapt these new technologies to very specific operational needs. They're not going to go back.
Yeah.
Those kinds of practices and those technologies are only going to get better. So is there a possibility of some slippage? Always. And again, I started by saying, you know, if this is all just based on oil prices, then, you know, none of it is necessarily secure. So we're looking at setting the Department of the Navy and Marines, on a path that isn't going to backtrack based on some temporary changes.
We had a discussion recently here about China and the way the government is structured there. And China's current five-year plan fundamentally changes the incentive structure for government officials in China and gives them, used to be all GDP growth, but grow the economy, the regime stays in power, everybody's happy. Now they have some energy goals as well. So how are you driving down inside the Navy these efficiency goals so that promotions and, I don't know if you get bonuses, whatever the compensation reward structure is tied to energy production rather than traditional metrics?
Right. And that gets perhaps into an area of the Navy that I'm not very knowledgeable about, but I can say yes, they are driving that down. Secretary Mabus has made sure that the use of energy and the ability to meet these goals is in fact something that the recognition system.
Beyond medals and sort of, you know, stars on the refrigerator, is someone going to get fired if they don't meet the goals or get promoted if they do?
Well, don't underestimate stars on the refrigerator.
Yeah. As a parent, we know, yes.
And I think the answer is, will that be the single factor? Of course not. But is that something that would be considered in people's performance and their career? Yes.
We're going to be able to put a microphone out here and invite your participation. It's better when you step up and participate. So please come up and present your questions. If you're just joining us on the radio, our guests today at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club are Jackie Fannisdale, Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and Jeremy Carl, a research fellow at the Hoover Institute at Stanford University. I'm Greg Dalton. Let's talk about, while people are coming up to the microphone, the line will form just right over there. Sure, okay, we can go ahead, since you were so speedy.
Thank you. Yes.
That was a forward deployment of a question. So.
Thank you so much for all the work you've been doing on this issue. The Department of the Navy has a very large presence in the Pacific, in the Hawaiian Islands, and also out in Guam and the territories. And we understand that there has been a great deal of work done by the Navy in Hawaii, particularly in the algae areas, and also working with some of the former sugarcane folks, because sugarcane is no longer grown commercially in Hawaii. It's gone to the Philippines. And also I understand that there's been a lot of looking at Guam in particular, because there's going to be a troop buildup likely at some point, we're not sure when, on Guam. And Guam being an island with a lot of sunshine, a lot of wind, some tidal. Could you tell us a little bit about those efforts, please?
Yes, thank you.
You get to travel to some nice spots.
I do. It is one of the high points in the position. I've been to Guam 4 times now. And we are looking at building a marine base in Guam. You're right, the timing is a little uncertain. But because we're spending a lot of time in Guam and we recognize all of the potential there, we've in fact been working with the National Renewable Energy Lab, NREL, which is one of the Department of Energy's labs, specifically to look at the potential for renewables in Guam. And they're out there practically as we speak looking at potential for wind, for solar, for some tidal, as well as some of the energy efficiency potentials. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit on improvements that can be done in Guam. Hawaii and NREL is doing a project for us both in Guam and in Hawaii, and in both cases looking at potential renewables. But Hawaii has a lot going on, both the military bases there, of which there are many, but also Hawaiian Electric is very interested in renewables and specifically in biofuels. So we've been working with a group that involves the military and Hawaiian Electric and many other stakeholders in Hawaii, both on biofuels and on solar. So I think that's perhaps the most advanced of any place in the United States right now.
If I could just add to that really
Jeremy Carl.
Briefly, because I think implicit in your question, but I think we should make it explicit because it's important. It matters that Hawaii and Guam are located where they are. In other words, places where you have situational opportunities to do this that are more cost-effective may be places that are islands that are more remote. Hawaii in particular has very high costs of traditional energy, so you do have an opportunity to sort of use those as test beds, and again, in ways that are sort of more durable to a budget process that may or may not go in your direction in the future. And so I think, again, that's a sort of unique thing that we have at some of our bases that are not here in the U.S., and particularly ones on islands like that.
Diego Garcia, it's got to be expensive to have energy there.
Absolutely.
Let's have our next audience question, please.
Good morning. Thank you for your time today. My name is Jonathan Kevlis with the Kevlis Group. My question is about the decision-making processes in the Navy and elsewhere in the government that go into making capital investment decisions, particularly those for, say, buildings or planes or fleets that are energy-intensive. Is it now rule or just a change in culture that, say, life cycle costs of an investment are taken into consideration rather than the capital budget person saying, well, I'm rewarded for doing something cheap, and I don't really care about the operational guy, what he has to pay for utility bills. So is there still a culture where some people do it based on an old way and other folks are mandated to do it on a life cycle cost basis? Or is life cycle cost analysis for investment decisions becoming mandatory?
Well, let me start by saying that my entire experience with the federal government procurement process is the last 18 months in this position. And I have found that the federal government procurement process is way beyond my area of expertise. But I can tell you a couple things that I do know. That within the Department of Defense, the services don't buy our own liquid fuels. That those decisions on what fuels to buy are done by the Defense Logistics Agency. And so, you know, we work with them, obviously, and we set the criteria to some extent. But those decisions are made centrally. And they make their decisions based on a whole variety of factors, price being, I think, one of the primary ones. In terms of other acquisitions, on the basis, for example, the decision as to whether to install solar panels or not, that's made for a number of reasons, a number of decisions. But I think that the actual question about how much to pay for a solar panel and whether that's a good investment as opposed to not is something that the local people have the first say in, but many of us have a finger in that. Whether it's a change in culture, I would say yes, because people are now more interested in energy efficiency. Is it totally, does that outweigh everything else? Probably not.
But when they're deciding to put solar panels on a base, do they consider the fact that a lot of coal was burned making those panels? Do they look at the whole life cycle of that material? Because a lot of photovoltaic involves a lot of nasty chemicals, and a lot of energy goes into the making of them.
I can't get very precise simply because I'm outside of my field of expertise in terms of what they do consider in there. But I can say that, no, they don't go through the whole life cycle. For example, do they assume a carbon cost of the electricity? Would an installation in North Carolina, for example, where a lot of the electricity is produced by coal, be able to consider that coal when they're deciding whether to put in a solar panel? Not really. I mean, I think that we can...
Is that a goal to consider that life cycle analysis?
I think the goal would be have a public policy, because our spending, any of the Defense Department's spending, is overseen by Congress. And so I have to go to Congress and defend our budget and defend what we have spent. And so it can be an argument, but it's not necessarily a policy.
These are not small questions either.
Absolutely.
In fact, there's a new hybrid drive ship that the Navy's blanking on the name offhand. I don't know if you happen to remember it.
The Macon Island.
And I just did a quick, based on some numbers that I got, you know, the life cycle cost savings on fuel, if you assume steady state over 50-year lifespan, which is a lousy thing to assume, but is at least functional for projecting, it's like $150 million savings just for that one ship.
Right.
So it's versus the conventional alternative. So it's not insignificant how we do treat these, but as Secretary Fancel noted, it's a very opaque and complex
but
process.
But those are ones that are relatively easy for us to do, because
right.
We can make that kind of assessment and say, let's put in a hybrid drive for this ship. But some of the others are murkier when you're talking about not buying electricity that's generated from coal. It's a harder decision to make.
Let's have our next audience question. Yes.
Hello. Good morning. My name's Elena Olmedo. I'm an intern for the Office of Environmental Policy and Compliance. And my question is about terrorism and how much terrorism affects our energy security and our infrastructure. And take, for example, the current grid that we have that uses technology from 100 years ago. How is the military involved in improving this security threat?
We have a few minutes left. Any questions?
We're very actively looking at specifically the vulnerability of the commercial electric grid for all of our installations. It is something that we've recognized, and it's frankly, it's not just the terrorists. It's fires. It's, you know, other kinds of issues that can affect the grid. What are we doing about it? We clearly have backup generation on all the bases to protect resources. But I think we're trying to get a little more sophisticated about that. I mentioned before that we're looking at ways of combining our bases into some smart grids and using those as a way of protecting ourselves from grid vulnerability. I think that as each of our bases, that, and we do buy mostly from the commercial grid, we're looking at what kind of backup do we have? Renewables make a lot of sense there. In some cases, you're putting in renewables as a grid backup, so it's not just comparing against the price of electricity you'd be buying from the local utility. You have another value for doing the renewables. So thank you for raising that. Good point.
And just to build on that, I was talking to Jim Woolsey yesterday, former CIA director, has been very involved in smart grid issues, and he sort of said, well, you know, where we're getting right now, we can kind of maybe stop the 9-year-old hackers, and we need to be able to stop maybe at least the 12-year-old hackers by doing some slightly bigger things. So there's a lot of vulnerability there. Again, this can be, we mentioned this in our report, but by having certain types of distributed energy, as Secretary Fahnenstiel alluded to, you can address that. And certainly for the military, one of the things that's surprising is even some of our international bases, they're pretty much dependent on these foreign grids in many cases that mm-hmm. we don't control. Now, the exact bases and what the dependencies are classified. So it's not fully known, but it is at least known that we haven't fully addressed that, and I think it's something that we absolutely need to address.
So if those bases generated their own power, they'd be more independent and secure. Let's wrap up quickly. Jeremy Carl, you're at the Hoover Institute and are part of Secretary Schultz's energy task force there. We both heard him say earlier this week that there's a lot of yakety-yak-yak on the political right about climate change and denial. And so I just want to close here by asking you, is that holding us back from these kinds of moves toward clean energy, that it's become a political litmus test in some circles to deny climate change and to say clean energy is hooey?
I didn't know better. I would swear that was a partisan question, which I would, I think, of course, avoid. I think obviously climate change, for better or for worse, actually I think pretty much for worse, I think definitively say, has become very politicized, become a political football. We can argue about what the origins of that are. I think maybe Al Gore being the initial spokesman was probably not the best political move, regardless of the substance, who at least was publicly identified with it. But certainly, I mean, regardless of one's views of anthropogenic climate change, and I believe personally largely in what the consensus science says about that, but there's a lot of people on the right who don't, and then there's a lot of people on the right who I think don't, or maybe do, but are very suspicious of the way that it will be handled by Democratic administrations or going to the UN.
But this is former Secretary of State,
sure,
saying there was yakety yak yak.
Sure. So. Well, Schultz has his opinions, and those should be respected, and I certainly do. I think one of the things Schultz has said to me on many occasions when we've talked about this is that ultimately, within 10 or 20 years, maybe not, this is not the ideal way, but it will become obvious that, in his view, something will be going on that will be pretty substantial, and that kind of you know, and I think ultimately that will be falsified one way. One of the two projections will be falsified, either the dire projection or the optimistic projection.
Right. As Bill McKibben says, the laws of physics and chemistry will trump the laws of Congress. We need to end it there. Our thanks to Jackie Fannisdale, Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and Jeremy Carl from Stanford's Hoover Institution for joining us today at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Greg Dalton. Thank you all for coming, listening on the radio, and joining us on C-SPAN. Thank you very much.